Hey everybody, it's Keith here. Welcome to the show. Today I'm really excited to welcome back to the Rogue Historian, Dr. Niels Eichhorn. Niels has been on the show before and he's always got cool stuff to say about transnational history and the history of slavery and Atlantic history. And today we're going to talk about his new book, Atlantic History in the 19th Century. And really we're going to kind of delve into some of the ideas in the book and how we might share them in the classroom. This is cool stuff, and I think it really provokes interesting and engaging conversation with students. And that's something that we are working on a lot these days here at The Rogue Historian. So you probably know Niels from the internet. You see him on there all the time. He's the chief editor at H Civil War and HNet Commons. So check him out there for sure. And then, you know, follow the links in the show notes for this particular podcast and find out all kinds of other cool stuff he's doing. All right, well, here we go. Let's welcome Niels to the show.
If they want something different, I'll deliver something different.
Isn't that funny how that works, though? Because, I mean, I did that once, too. I was researching my PhD dissertation, and I went down a rabbit hole at the archives. Yep. I was in Richmond. It was either the Library of Virginia or the Museum of the, I can't remember where it was that I was researching it. But anyway, I found like some files with all of these soldier letters and various correspondence, and they really resonated with me. And I went, wow, this is really cool stuff. And so I spent like, and I probably shouldn't say this out loud because I was getting funded to do research for one particular thing. But hey, that was what, you know, 15 years ago, I'm sure. So I took this research and I quietly set aside a week and just like really focused on this. And it turned into an article and a chapter in a book. A few years down the line. I love that kind of stuff. When you just like accidentally stumble on something, it becomes like a side project, you know? And and it winds up, you know, bearing fruit. Well, that's cool.
Yeah. Man. I mean, that's sort of like how this book got born.
Yeah.
Like, it was sort of a methodological question of, like, how do you frame the dissertation? And boom. No, this doesn't work. Oh, well, but I haven't done all those readings, so how can I use that now?
So that's a good place to start. Niels, first of all, I didn't even say, hey, welcome to the show. You know, you're a repeat offender now.
I am.
So you are in a small club of repeat offenders on this show, and so welcome back. I think that's a great place to start. This book, your newest book, Atlantic History in the 19th Century, Migration, Trade, Conflict, and Ideas, that came out, last year? Let me look, hold on.
November.
November 2019, so it's pretty fresh here. What inspired you, since we're talking about that, what inspired you to write this one?
Well, it started with figuring out what the methodological framework for the dissertation was going to be like, and one of the aspects I looked at was Atlantic history. Of course, David Armitage came up with this idea of, like, you have these three different ways to do Atlantic history. You have the cisatlantic, circumatlantic, and transatlantic, which is like community study or kind of a broad overview of the Atlantic world, or a comparative study. And I kind of felt like what I was doing in the rotation was somewhat comparative in nature, but as I was digging more into it, I kind of eventually turned away from the Atlantic framework and went more for the transnational frameworks that you have with Andre Flesch and Paul Quigley in the Civil War. But at the same time, having done a good bit of reading on this Atlantic history framework, I kind of was like looking at it and doing mid-19th century history, kind of this revolutionary Atlantic from 48 into the Civil War era, I kind of was like, well, it seems like we're having a lot of migrants that are going from Europe with ideas into the Americas, which is somewhat Atlantic in nature, but why aren't we ever talking about this? Why are we ending this study of Atlantic world in 1825, roundabout? Depends on who you talk to. Some scholars put it earlier, some people a little later, but that's roughly where you want to end it. And as I was digging through it, I kind of was finding these stories like Giuseppe Garibaldi, who's this Italian nationalist who goes to South America and then eventually comes to the United States very briefly. And there's always this fascination that you have in the United States with Garibaldi leading into the Civil War. Or you have these Irish migrants that are going back, the Fenian movement, the Atlantic slave trade. So I had these little episodes, and I kind of was like, what can I do with them so that I don't waste all this work that I've done? And initially, I was thinking, let's write an article maybe for the American Historical Association's journal. Well, that article in this first draft was like 50 pages. And I was like, no, that just doesn't work. So I kind of was like, okay, let's expand it. And it started growing and growing, and eventually it turned into a book project. And I kind of was like, all right, let's. I was playing with it on and off. I did a little bit in 2013 with it. Then I kind of restarted it 3 or 4 years ago while I was waiting on Liberty and Slavery to go through its processes. And I kind of was. Yeah, it's sort of this weird project that you have by the side that you play with every once in a while that eventually culminated in a publication.
It's a great story. I mean, I think that probably happens a lot with scholars. I've took a book project and I'm narrowing it down to an article because I've found that I think it'd be much more focused. So I think it works the other
Sure.
way sometimes too. But this is a really interesting story, and it was making me think about when I was in graduate school, and that was like the Atlantic world, everything we looked at, that was like right when it was really taking off, I think, for a lot of people. It came to light early in the 2000s, and everybody was sort of reorienting their focus toward an Atlantic, looking at it through an Atlantic lens. And it was very, very trendy, very hip, very cool stuff in American history for sure. And I think in your book, in the introduction, you mentioned Jack Rakoff worked a lot, and it's strangely, his son Rob was one of the first guests on this show. He and I went to grad school together, so it's a family legacy there. But
There you go.
he does diplomatic history in the 20th century. So they're on different they're in different worlds for sure. But anyhow, and you note that the conventional narrative really ends. Atlantic history, Atlantic world history is really an 18th century phenomenon, really.
Yeah, it
And
is. And
go ahead, go ahead, go ahead.
it's somewhat sad because I think there's so much when you really think about it. And this is sort of like where the Atlantic narratives are so convergent because it's like some treated like this imperial history that once the empires are gone, like the Spanish Empire in 1825, it's over. Or it's like a very slave-based narrative. And then by the 1880s was Spanish and Brazilian emancipation, it's over. But at the same time, and in part, I kind of started looking at it too with Wim Kloster's book, where he compares the American, French, Haitian, and Spanish American revolutions. And it's a revolutionary Atlantic as well. And there, sort of like, I kind of laid the foundation early on that I was like, well, but the age of revolutions is more than the American Revolution to independence of Spanish America, because a lot of that language is dating back to the 1680s with Great Britain, and it goes on into the 1840s, I mean, even 1860s. You can find still some of that language in the American Civil War if you wanted to. So it's these overlapping narratives, right, that make it so difficult to say where is a good end. Of course, all the big scholars have sort of like, this is the end, and don't argue with me,
Well,
which
they are pretty
stuff that's
important
very
guys.
difficult.
It does. It's one of the things that I do in the classroom a lot is I challenge this idea of kind of rigid periodization. Whether I'm teaching like my ninth graders, European history or something, we're talking about the fall of the Roman Empire. Just these kinds of things. When does it really end? Or does it really end? Does it evolve, change, overlap with other things? And we do that with all kinds of stuff. And I like to challenge strict periodization only because, I might be wrong. I'm definitely not an expert on a lot of these things that I talk about, but at least it gets the kids to think about things in different ways.
Well, I think that's the biggest goal when you talk about history, and especially Atlantic history. And this book offers that was sort of what I wanted to set out with, that I wanted to make people saying of like, you know that little story, but let's put that story into a bigger context. So like, let it engage with other parts of the world. And obviously, I mean, you look back sometimes and you look and say, well, if I'd written it today, I would write it differently, or there would be more stories. But on some level, it's also like the balancing act of like, how how many stories can you find, how many stories can you put into conversation with each other without it becoming a 500-page monolith that no one wants to read anymore, right? That's the other challenge. And that's sort of what I aim for by going with stories like Garibaldi's, where I wanted the personal, I wanted this to be about individuals that people could connect with, because I think that where you talk about the classroom, that's a thing like, what do kids look to? They look to their comic book heroes, they look to the movie hero, maybe we can create some figure in history that gives them inspiration, that talks to them.
Yeah. It will certainly give them, you know, a person that they can sort of latch on to, identify with, you know, some sort of, you know, human face on a lot of these more abstract ideas. And speaking of abstractions, I mean, you mentioned imperialism and
yes,
this being part of the story of imperialism. And I was thinking about, you know, Eric Hobsbawm and his phrasing of the long 19th century and the period between, you know, 1789 to 1914, and how, you know, if you look at the beginnings of the French Revolution and the beginnings of World War One, how incredibly different the world looks in those two big sort of, you know, cataclysmic changes. You know, what can you speak a little bit to that? The comparing the Atlantic world of, you know, revolutionary France to the Atlantic world of World War One. Europe.
Sure, and in part you're touching on a really interesting subject there with regard to the periodization of the book, because initially I had intended to be chronologically a lot shorter, and it was sort of the feedback that I received from peers in the field and then from the peer reviewers that was like, why, you need something better, you need something more cataclysmic as these points in time where you start and you finish. And yeah, it's somewhat like the easy way out to say, let's do the French Revolution and do World War One. But I think in many ways, that's really the moments in time that breaks this world apart, because the French Revolution is really the cataclysmic moment that changes everything. It brings about the independence of Spanish America. It brings about the events in Saint-Domingue, Haiti. It's a language that people will continue to use for the next 50 plus years. And obviously there is change over time. I think that's the other part that's really challenging about writing this book, that it was, this is not a static story. This is a story of this change, where there's a lot of revolution at the start of the century. There's 1830, there's 1848, there's the Civil War period, there's this movement of frontiers, and then you get to the late 19th century, it's a completely different cast of characters, a completely different set. But I think imperialism is the one part that does have an overarching theme that comes to the book, where it's like the French Revolution effectively ends the French Empire. And for a moment there in the early 19th century, you have this reluctance. Why should we do empire? France is not in the capacity to do it. Spain is a third-rate, fourth-rate, fifth-rate power by this stage. Germany and Italy are not unified. Leaves the only Great Britain, really, as a major power. And being the dominant power economically, they don't need to do empire. They don't need to control any areas. But by 1830, as the French go, they're looking at Algeria, again, as an imperial possession. You're starting to see explorers go into Africa. They're looking for resources. And by the middle of the 19th century, Spain is thinking about imperial growth temporarily there. The French going into Mexico. And then Africa becomes the scrambling spot. And I think it's sort of the weird irony of what I'm doing with it, because it's like, Africa is what starts the Atlantic world. The slave trades, the search for gold that the Portuguese and Spanish have when they go down the coast to find, like, the gold fields of Ghana. And then you end up with, where do we end? By 1914, Africa is again the scrambling spot of the Atlantic world, because you have all these colonial powers that want to take parts of Africa and extract the resources. But I think that's where I brought the story of Henry Sylvester Williams into it, because there is just like what we have with the early Atlantic, that push on the Africans, the resistance on the Africans, there is that too by the 1900s, that Africans are not willing to just accept European powers coming in there and taking their land. So there is this, there is the imperial narrative, but there also is a resistance to that imperial narrative.
Very interesting stuff. Some key ideas that I got thinking about, I started thinking about when I was reading this is, you know, the things that we debate all the time about the meaning of these words and how different regions, and as an Americanist, I often think about this in American context. But, you know, we can, of course, expand on it. But the 19th century ideas of progress, 19th century ideas of capitalism, and what capitalism means in an Atlantic community. And I think you'll even see contemporary debates in the 19th century about whether or not, you know, the slave South is really a capitalist, a capitalist economy or not. I mean, of course, it's profit driven and various things that would suggest capitalism. But then on the other hand, you know, there's other issues too that, that free labor advocates would be very critical of the institution because of its, you know, retarding progress and various other things that they would accuse it of. So how would you situate the Atlantic world in terms of these ideas of progress and these ideas of capitalism?
Well, in large part, I think when you consider the idea of capitalism, I, especially in the early part of the 19th century, I like to think of it in part in the plantation context, but also in the part of trade, the commodities that are going out of these, especially the U.S. South, slave economies. And then you have the sugar, coffee industry in the Caribbean and Brazil. And they're driving the industrialization in Europe, obviously. And it's the commodities that come out of Europe, these industrial commodities that go into the Americas. And trade was really one of the big aspects that I was looking at to kind of figure out what am I dealing with? Because one of the things that you always hear in Atlantic history, why does it end? It's like, it's a global narrative eventually. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at trade statistics from Britain, I was looking at it from France, the German states, and one of the things that was very quickly clear was there is not a major Asian trade yet. People are, there's a distance, obviously, there's the interest in China, but China just doesn't have the capacity that the Atlantic states have. There's just so much more history within the Atlantic community of trade that, yeah, the French Revolution, Napoleonic Wars, made it more difficult for a few years, but it just, it's there. It's that interaction where certain states say, well, we ought to trade primarily with South America. British investment will go phenomenally strong into places like Argentina. You have business houses, banking houses that will focus their activities into Brazil. So it's a flow of money, it's a flow of commodities that really, I think, drives this interaction in the Atlantic world. And that just goes, it gets bigger and bigger. I mean, if we think of progress as a kind of growing and accumulation and increase in whatever you want it to be, trade, ships. I mean, think about, we're dealing with small sailing vessels by the start of the 19th century. By the end of it, we're talking about luxury liners like the Titanic crossing the Atlantic. So it's like,
not quite. We made it halfway across anyway.
Yeah, the irony of, like, I never forget the scene when I was watching that movie and the ship was sinking while we're crossing over Newfoundland.
Wow, really? That's
an interesting. Yeah, it kind of a little off, but it's those stories, right? Mm-hmm. It's this, the growth, the changes that happen, but it's a moving of increasing activity, increasing changes. But the thing too is that where you think of capitalism or progress, I think we also need to always consider that there is the agency of these different states that, yes, you're Chilean businessman who wants to build a railroad is most likely to go to London and look at the banking houses and financial institutions there. But he's doing that because he knows that's the only place he can get that much money. There is the surge. I love the story of this the Chilean community seeking German immigrants. You have Irish immigrants being sought in Peru. It's this desire. We know there's people in these various European countries whose characteristics we want, so we'll bring them here so that they can help us change our economy, our environment. And so it is that goal then of capitalism, but at the same time, there's also what I really kind of struggled a little bit with this, and in part it's struggle because the literature just isn't quite there yet, I think, how you have resistance to that capitalism, the kind of the Marxism that you start to see after 1848, this kind of revolutionary attitudes, the anarchism that you see, and all of it crosses the Atlantic. I mean, you're looking at things like what for us Americanists, like Chicago, Haymarket Revolt, but you have anarchist and socialist movement in South America as well. And in part, it's based on the groups that move to these countries, like Italians, Spanish bring their ideals of socialism, Marxism to South America, while German, British, Irish migrants will bring theirs to the United States. But what I've kind of really felt, and probably could be fleshed out even more so, and I hope somebody will, I think there's a good comparison between what happened in Saint-Domingue, the slave rebellion against this exploitation of the slave in the sugar plantations, and how it dominates. Like, planters are fearful over the next decades of what does it mean? What does it mean when we talk about emancipation and slaves rise up in the same fashion? Industrialists and states in the last quarter of the 19th century look to the Paris Commune and are like scared of what will happen if workers decide to take matters into their own hands and overthrow government, establish their own little communes and small little governments. And I think that kind of ties it back to this capitalism, the fears surrounding capitalism, though, too.
Since you brought up revolutions, I think this is a good segue into my next question is I think, people who are informed about history, students of history, when they think of revolutions, I think they think of radicalism, right? I think those two words are often associated, but you have a chapter in your book called Conservative Revolutions. And that struck me as a phrase that some people might think of as an oxymoron. How can you have a conservative revolution? Doesn't make any sense. And so I kind of wanted you to speak to that. And then I'd like to discuss whether or not you think that the American Revolution is a conservative revolution.
Oh my, you're really setting me up there.
I am, huh? That's a good
That is a that's a really good
one.
one. I fully agree, and I but you know what's the one part that always drives me crazy as a Civil War historian is when I read in Civil War literature of like this radical fire eater that does something. I'm like, no, the fire eater is not a radical. He's a very reactionary figure because he doesn't want to move into a better future. He wants to go back to a utopian past that never existed. But yes, it sounds paradoxical to say that we have something like a conservative revolution, but I think when we really perceive of it, what is happening in the mid-19th century Atlantic world? In 1848, we try, especially in Europe, but this also applies in a number of South American countries, we're trying to bring about constitutional government. We're wanting to go against either monarchical rulers or dictators of some sorts in South America. Well, it doesn't work out. These revolutions, because they don't have the power of the military attached to them, oftentimes fail. But it's this wake-up call to the conservative elites, especially in Europe, but this again applies in other parts as well, that unless they co-opt some of the ideals that the liberals stand for, things like a more representative government, more say to the people, i.e., through voting, some form of rule of law that everyone has to abide by, unless they embrace these, there's going to be more revolutions. It's just not going to stop. And that's really the linchpin for that conservative revolutions chapter, of these conservatives adopting the views of liberals for their own purposes. The result is what you see, for example, in Italy and Germany. You have these conservative political figures who create, in war mostly, nation states. They bring all the people that belong to a certain nationality, speak the same language, share traditions, together. And then they impose governments that are responsive to them, like Bismarck's Germany. It has universal manhood suffrage. It's more democratic than the United States is, in many regards, at the time. Yet, the body that is elected by this universal manhood suffrage has hardly any power. Yes, it has power of a budget, but the executive branch of the German Empire is not responsive or responsible to that body. So in that regard, yes, we have these major revolutionary changes, but not really much has changed when it comes to the governing. It just creates a certain veneer that, yes, the people have a say, we want them to have a say, but we don't have to listen to what they say. And I think in many ways, when you look at even on some levels, the American, not the American Revolution, the American Civil War, if you think of it as a revolutionary moment, yes, we have the emancipation of slavery. Yes, we have this, what many have termed the new birth of freedom or the second revolution. But what do we come out with? We come out with the Gilded Age eventually, which is an incredibly conservative kind of attitude. I mean, I always like when I teach class, when I teach 1830, the French Revolution in 1830, I bring up this image of Marianne, where she half undressed on her chest, storms with a flag, leading the man towards the enemy. And it's like, this is a radical revolution. She's trying to show more of her body, her skin. And then I'm pivoting over to the Statue of Liberty. I'm like, think about how radical the United States is perceived when the Statue of Liberty goes up, considering how much clothes Lady Liberty wears.
Very interesting. I never thought of it that way. I never really thought about that visual before. But yeah, I guess that that makes a lot of sense.
So I think there's a more conservative streak eventually that just throughout. I mean, you can look at Porfirio Diaz in Mexico as another example of this. And in many ways, it's saying that the conservative embrace of these liberal views allows them to just revolutionize how government works. And I think that goes against many of the thinkings in especially U.S. scholarships that you can't be conservative and revolutionary. You can be a monarchy and embrace democracy. It doesn't have to be a republic that embraces democracy. And I think that's those kind of challenges to pose to readers.
You brought up the fire eaters is an interesting way, I think, to look at this. The fire eating, the secessionist movement in the Confederacy. Since you're a Civil War historian, this is right up your alley. And I think that they embrace, I think, and you know, you might challenge me on this if you want, but I think that they embrace sort of a revolutionary spirit, at least in the beginning, associate themselves with the framers of the United States, right? The revolutionary spirit of the United States, in against perceived oppression, and then once they get the ball rolling, they almost immediately fall back on a sort of imagined version of, you know, or their perceived version of what the framers had intended to begin with. So they're not really revolutionaries at all. In fact, you know, from their point of view, they're the true inheritors of this, and in fact, a very conservative kind of movement. So, is it an American Revolution as like the Americans, you know, another American Revolution, like, you know, like the Americans of the 1770s, or, you know, something completely different? So, I think that they are aware of what they're doing, and very carefully framing this so as not to appear like the radicals, like the ones that had gotten off track. Right, it's the Yankees, it's the fanatics in the North who have gotten off track, not us. that's the way I've always looked at it, and I kind of even and again, you can come after me for this if you want, but and I remember first hearing about this and it kind of a little light bulb in my head when I was an undergraduate at UCLA, I think in Joyce Appleby's class, in like the 90s, I can't remember, a long time ago, but that kind of debate came up in her class. It's like, you know, is the American Revolution really kind of a similar type thing? Is it a bunch of, is it a group of people who saw, you know, who saw the rule of law getting thrown out the window, who saw the potential of pandemonium and chaos if they didn't get things back the way that they had, you know, they should have, according to the English, you know, Bill of Rights and Constitution, the writ of habeas corpus, these types of things.
Well, and it seems that brings us back to your other question of, like, how conservative or radical is the American Revolution. I think that's, in part, it's a difficult question, right? Because when I teach, especially world history, I'm always like, forget about that American Revolution. No one cares about that one. Everyone cares about the French Revolution. Because that is so much more earth-shattering than anything that happens. Now, does that mean because the death toll and executions are so much more high that it just makes the American Revolution not as radical? But at the same time, when I'm thinking about it, and there have been some really interesting studies of, well, when you look at it at the start, what are these revolutionaries in the colonies want? They don't want independence. They just want the status quo return to pre-Seven Years' War.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, that's not very radical. I mean, that's why you had to have the Declaration of Independence, because otherwise the French would have looked at the United States and be like, well, good luck, because why would we help you be better British colonists?
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, I think the American Revolution does not strike me as a very radical event.
Right.
Does it strike me as very conservative? No, it's somewhat in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the difficulty there is that we have to consider that the American Revolution is very much building on the Glorious Revolution, initially, with its ideology.
Yeah.
And
the introduction of a Bill of Rights,
the
introduction
Declaration of Rights by the British.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we have to keep it in mind that there's these different stages that we rebel against Parliament's control, Parliament's excess with regard to taxation. Well, then we're going to look at it and be like, well, eventually we don't like the king who is mishandling the war, so we're going to create a government that is not very monarchist by creating the Articles of Confederation and giving the states all the power and creating this very loose confederation. Well, then we figure out that doesn't work well, or at least some people in the country feel that it doesn't work well, and we go back to something that some have argued looks very much like a monarchy without a monarch in creating a very strong presidency. So it's, I guess in many ways depends on when you look at the American Revolution of how do you characterize it. I mean, looking back at it from our perspective of the Constitution and what the Constitution has created over the over the centuries by this stage, it looks extremely conservative in how little it actually changed when you think about it.
Yeah, it's a great conversation to have with the kids, have with my students. I love having this kind of, because that always strikes them as weird. When I drop that on them, they go, huh, wait, I don't know, that doesn't seem right. And then I try to compare it to the French Revolution, which I do think is actually pretty radical. I mean, by the time you get to you know, the phase of the revolution that really spins into violence and and all that kind of thing that was going on, you know, in Paris during the Terror. One of the things we were talking about right at the beginning of the show that I'd like you to expand on is that, you know, I, as a high school teacher, I've done really kind of put a lot of effort into bringing today's scholarship, new scholarship, you know, innovative scholarship, interesting takes on historical topics and bringing those into the classroom. My point is what I want to teach my kids, especially, you know, by the time I get them into the advanced courses, you know, in their junior and senior years, is that this discipline is a very much a work in progress, and we are continually evolving and revising our ideas. And it's not just a narrative written in, carved out in granite, and it's not just a series of dates, a sequence of events that we all agree upon. No, it's much more than that, in that, you know, that's what I'm trying to teach them, that we are constantly just, you know, adding to the, gathering more data, changing our understandings of things. And we're all in debate all the time. Historians never agree on anything, which is, I think, is great.
Right.
We're constantly arguing. I think you and I agree on some things, but, there's probably some difference in there somewhere.
We can find them.
I'm sure we can find them. I remember when I was in grad school disagreeing with my advisor all the time about stuff, and it was great conversations. But that's the point, because it gets us closer to where we're going, And I try to get them to understand that's how we do things. So I bring books like yours and we talked about your other book, Liberty and Slavery, in my Civil War class. In fact, I lent it to one of my students who took off with it and, started talking about all this transnational stuff,
There you go.
It's like, hey, I got, a junior in high school that's, really going to town with, all these transnational arguments and stuff. Very cool. Very cool to see them, grab this stuff and run with it.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, exactly. But so let's take your new book on Atlantic history and how would you suggest that? And I've got some ideas of my own, but how would you suggest I introduce this to my Civil War students, maybe, or maybe I teach an honors U.S. history survey too. How might I introduce the ideas in this book to those kinds of kids?
In large part, I think you can use some of the chapters. I wouldn't probably give them the first two, the economic, the trade chapter and the migration chapter tend to be a little bit duller because of the number game that I have to play and kind of setting everything up. But after that, I think there's some really interesting chapters to play with because, like the frontier chapter, I think that's a beautiful one for especially younger generation kids that kind of looking at, hey, you may have that image of the American cowboy, and I love when I taught in US2 the American cowboy, like the American West. I brought up this old Goofy cartoon that Disney did in the 1920s of like Goofy being transplanted out of the American West as a cowboy down to South America and the Argentine Pampas as a gaucho. It's like, when you really think about it, the American cowboy is only like a 20, 25 year phenomenon during the big cattle rash. Cattle drives, and then you get barbed wire eventually, and all that starts to disappear. But then you look at the vaquero in Mexico, the llaneros, the gauchos; those are much longer lasting phenomena of the herding environment. But it's all the same. Like eventually, it's the barbed wire that destroys for all of them their livelihoods because you don't need a cowboy group anymore to watch animals when you keep them under check with a piece of metal. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's that story. There's the migration aspect of it that kind of, this is a bit old school, but if somebody has played that Oregon Trail game or has kind of this imagination of like moving westward migration, the trails, and it's like, here's this conversation of, here's people moving along the trails westward like the Mormons. At the same time, you have this movement of people in South Africa from the coast inland with the Boer. Yeah. So there's that comparison. Or like one of the earliest that I kind of found where you did kind of like comparative native conflict stories was like the campaign that eventually culminates with Custer's Last Stand at Little Bighorn. And this comparative situation of like what the Zulu do to the British in South Africa. So that, I think, is something really inspiring for students because it's these heroic figures that they have potentially heard about and they're now being put into a different conversation with other people in other areas of the world that are all struggling with the same challenges. At the same time, the other part that, and this is two sections that I really love about the book, and ironically one of them is really like last minute writing actually, is a tourism chapter. I actually was reading that chapter, proofreading that chapter, I think it was a Saturday in October, just before the book was coming out, and it was the exact same day that they announced that Thomas Cook was going bankrupt after 140, 50 years of existence. And I was reading about Thomas Cook in that moment, and I actually brought it up in class the next day and kind of was like, this just happened. Let's talk about that for a moment, because we're all going on vacation, but where does this packaged tourism cruises come from, right? It's like, it's not that you have Carnival Cruise all of a sudden drop from the skies and we're all going on cruises into the Caribbean or in the West Coast case, Alaska or maybe Mexico's Baja California. it's a long history of people go on vacations. How do you sell this? How do you market this in context of like a group of people that has very little money? Like Thomas Cook was initially marketing himself towards a more working class group of people. But you start, and eventually what you start was like a small excursion into Paris by circuitous routes, because you have a difficult time finding individuals that want to transport people. Eventually grows into a global empire where you have the ability to sell tours to people. So that I think is something just fascinating of people thinking about road trips, thinking about like they go online today and like, oh, this is a great route to take that somebody else took. Well, that all builds back to people, pioneers, potentially in the 19th century, having worked this out. And there's just these possibilities, travelogues that you could bring into class. Like, I only restricted myself to three tourists because I kind of was like, I just want to give you a little bit of a personal feel in that chapter. And I did. The Marquis de Lafayette and Theodore Roosevelt and Dom Pedro as kind of really big name tourists. In part, it's kind of tough to think of Lafayette as a tourist when he comes through the United States, but we kind of can think of it.
Yeah, sure.
And my wife was looking through that chapter because she was proofreading it for me, and she just was like, wow, Lafayette came through Macon and talked about Macon in his travelogue. And then there's this other story of like going through the Mississippi and Ohio, and the boat almost capsized and the general dies. But she used that next time when she talked about Lafayette in class. And she was kind of like, oh, let me talk to my students about this, of how this big name person came through this little town in the middle of nowhere at the time in Georgia. So I think that's, again, somewhat where you can kind of draw students in and inspire them and kind of think about how this Atlantic world in the 19th century still has resemblances to our world today.
It's very interesting, you know, especially in Southern California, where I teach. I think that would resonate with them particularly well because we're, you know, we're a very much part of the tourist industry here.
Right.
I mean, well, not today. Obviously, we are in, you know, in the midst of this global pandemic, so our tourist economy is kind of taking a bit of a nosedive.
Sure.
And so much of where I live in Hollywood is, you know, so much of the revenue here in Hollywood is just dependent upon that tourist economy. So we'll see how things go, but that's a story for another day.
Yes.
I have for my seniors, I have this. It's a historiography seminar where they write a historiographical paper their first semester, and when they're senior, the second semester is when they're all thinking about, you know, they're done, right? They, you know, high school
Right.
seniors have checked out, you know, a couple weeks into their second semester. They're thinking about, you know, other things, getting
All
into
his freshman
college,
year.
exactly. And so what I did was I designed this kind of, you know, sort of a chill class on the history of Los Angeles, which is it
Yeah.
was kind of fun. It was this year was my first year teaching. We had a great time. And it kind of got abbreviated because, you know, we went to distance learning. So I couldn't do a lot of the things that I wanted to do, like all the field trips. But
Right.
to make a very long, long, long story here, kind of a little bit shorter, one of the things that we talked about was the tourist industry and identity, regional identity. And Helen Hunt Jackson came up and her stories about Ramona, and, you know, that whole, like, the Rancho system in Southern California and all that kind of stuff that is really so much a part of our identity, but it's been, you know, completely paved over now. You wouldn't even know it except for a few small little examples of it here and there with the missions that are still around and stuff.
Right.
But it's such an important part of our culture from the very beginning, you
Yeah.
know, and so much part of our identity. So that'd be a great way to get them to talk about that, to see if this, you know, it is a sort of Atlantic phenomenon for sure.
Yeah.
One more question for you before I let you go, is about social media because I am fascinated by historians' work on social media, and you do a lot of stuff on there. I see you popping up all the time doing videos on the battlefields and interviews with other historians and all these really interesting things. You've got a lot of stuff going on in social media, which is great. Because I think that there is such a vast audience for the things that we do that aren't necessarily a part of the part of academia,
Yes.
but still, you know, but still are well read and well informed and want to talk. And I'm curious as to, or even, you know, how much of this you've included in your social media presence. But the current ideas that you have about Atlantic history and stuff, does that resonate well on? Does it translate well into the social media world, or is this something that you kind of separate from that?
That's a really interesting question. I kind of stumble here a little bit because it's like you are very true that there's a lot of great stories in the Atlantic book that could resonate rather well with people.
Mm-hmm.
And I, because I'm so much as marketing myself as a Civil War historian and work so much in Civil War history, this book has sort of been a little bit site delegated, that it's not necessarily the focus of my activities, which honestly is sad because, come to think of it, I mean, it has a lot of great material in it and probably deserves way more attention. Now, hopefully no one from the press listens, but I do think it's a little overpriced.
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, hey, I think academic presses can do that sometimes.
Yes, they can. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I would like to see it used a lot more in classrooms like yours or like undergraduate courses, because I really think the book is, the goal of the book that I set out writing is, I can't answer everything. There's stories that I'm aware of that I just couldn't integrate. There's people that I would have liked to know more about that I couldn't get enough material on. There were stories that I had to cut out because they didn't work in the framework that I was giving it.
And you're very transparent about that, by the way, in the introduction. You talk about this is, we're limited into what we can do. There's
right,
always,
but that's sort of where I hope that this is sort of like if a student reads about it and it's like, wait a minute, I know a story here that could work in this framework, and or something that I state that they disagree with, that maybe something that they can take their own scholarship on then. I think in that regard, that's really the goal, was the goal of this book. This book was not going to be an answer. This is a book that's hopefully starting a conversation, people to ask more questions, because the most frustrating part in researching this was probably Latin America. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to do more with Latin America. I'm just right now looking at Civil War diplomacy again a lot more, and one of, again, the most frustrating parts is Latin America for me, because it's like, there's a lot of great social history done for Latin America, but there's very little political history or revolutionary history. I mean, I can't find, for the love of God of me, sometimes materials that relates to like these various revolutions that take place in Latin American countries in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And like, I know that about every 5 years in certain countries there's an overthrow of government, but no one has written about it. In at least not in the English language, and sort of that's those moments where you're like, man, wouldn't it be nice?
Well, maybe that's where this will take us.
That's where maybe social media can help and be like a little bit more encouragement given.
Mm. Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, Niels, as always, it was great talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show. You're welcome back anytime. You seem to have a pretty rigorous publishing schedule, so I'm sure you'll have it back on. I'm sure I'll have you back on within the next 3 or 4 months. With your next book, right? Isn't that how it works with you?
we can maybe play that with some Make and Balance book, but that's probably later this year.
All right, good. Well, thanks again for coming on, man.
Thank you.
And it's good to see you. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner. I am currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Allen in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War Letters of Henry A. Allen. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.